Hello and welcome to Playback Daily for Monday the 24th of March. I'm Louise Herity and here's just some of what's coming up.
No, it's absolutely not about restricting children from the online world, and we need to be really clear about that. It's about creating a safe online space for children to be able to access all of the brilliant things that the online world does provide for them.
These are the people whose jobs are designed to make sure we don't sleep and our attention isn't on the things that we probably should be doing, including the people we love, which is a huge part of my own reasons why I got off the phone.
This might not happen for us the way it does for so many other couples. We might have to get extra help. Mm. We might have to spend quite a lot of money. We might have to invest so much of ourselves to extend our family. That weekend, I don't think I'll ever forget.
Taoiseach Simon Harris recently called for parents to consider delaying access to smartphones for their children due to what he described as a toxic online environment. He also said that Adolescence, the Netflix drama about a teenage boy who becomes violent after being influenced by misogynists on social media, should be compulsive viewing in every secondary school in Ireland. Now, it comes as a growing number of parents wrestle with whether or not to give their children a smartphone as they prepare to go into secondary school. Sheila Nocton had this report on Morning Ireland.
Cyberbullying has happened a lot, and it's happened to me twice by the same person. I have told my parents, and at the time it was a bit scary. They told me to block the person who was contacting me.
Sixth class student Evelina there from St. Paul's National School in Dúradóil, Limerick, talking about her experience of cyberbullying through apps on her smartphone. A recent survey of parents with children under 16 by AIR found 42% gave their child a phone earlier than they'd like. But some parents in South Dublin have had enough of this pressure and have set up a Delay Smartphones or social media WhatsApp group. They're supporting parents with children going into first year across a number of schools in the area to hold off on phones or social media. Gillian Hurley is one mother working on the initiative.
It really started from myself and another mum talking about our own views on children and smartphones. And we were pretty adamant that we didn't want to give our 12-year-old sons who are in sixth class smartphones. We discussed the idea of setting up a WhatsApp group. Within 2 or 3 days of starting the group, there was, I think, over 100 parents had joined it. We wanted it to be easier for our sons, if we weren't giving them a phone, that they wouldn't feel so left out by being the only ones. I know it's going to be difficult, and I'm sure I will have arguments with my son about it, but I really feel it's about giving the internet access to my child. And I think there's much higher risks and more harmful implications to him with that than having to live with using an alternative. I think that really is the lesser of two evils.
For some parents in this group, they're attempting to put the genie back in the bottle, per se. Ross Staunton's eldest daughter got a phone after sixth class. However, he doesn't want his son, who's starting first year in 2025, to have one.
We caved in to our daughter and she got a phone about a month before she went into secondary school. We would love to have not done that 2 years ago. And I suppose the main thing was we had this feeling that she'd be left out of social groups, thought that might be more detrimental than giving her the phone in the first place. But if there is an initiative now within the school, we feel we have the opportunity now to hold off because there are other kids who won't have phones. It's an easier sell and an easier conversation to our son to say that, look, you won't be the only one.
With smartphones comes social media. A CyberSafe Kids survey of 8 to 12-year-olds recently found that 32% of respondents had been upset by something they experienced online last year, but only half spoke to a parent or trusted adult. Caroline Santos-Murray, child and parental psychologist at the Tree of Life Clinic BlackRock, says she's seeing more cases of children distressed because of cyberbullying, online sexual abuse and intimidation online.
They know something is wrong, but especially in that age, they really want to belong. Sometimes they just keep going. They feel anxiety level coming up. Sometimes they can't name it, but then the parents or the teachers at school notice more irritability, changes on behavior, or even isolation.
However, she does caution that restricting smartphones or social media should come with clear reasoning from parents.
Sometimes we want to impose something. Sometimes the child doesn't know why. It's very clear in the parents' head that's maybe dangerous, or maybe it's impacting development, or maybe bringing more anxiety or things like that. But sometimes the child has no clue why. It's just an imposition. Have a talk with your child.
But what do children making the move from primary to secondary school think? We return to St. Paul's National School in Dura Doyle to hear if these students have phones and why.
I have a phone to contact my parents in case of emergency, or sometimes they play games on it.
So when I'm home alone, my parents can contact me, and if I have to walk home from school, they can call me and I can call them. I have TikTok and Instagram. There's not really any rules. I just can't be on my phone for too long.
My parents actually have parental controls on my phone. I just have WhatsApp and Roblox.
I haven't been given a phone because my parents don't want me having one, because they know a lot of bad things can happen on the phone.
A lot of bad things can happen on the phone. Children there from St. Paul's National School in Dura Doyle. Ending that report by Sheila Nocton. We can speak now to Owen Cleary. He's a secondary school teacher at Temple Carrick and Greystones in County Wicklow and works on social, personal and health education, as well as developing programmes around sex and consent. Good morning, Owen, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Morning, John.
Should children going into secondary schools get a smartphone?
With the lack of regulation and protections currently online for children, I would say no, absolutely not. They're being exposed to a whole myriad of damaging and dangerous content, and the risk to their welfare is too high. Saying that, it's great that parents are getting together and supporting each other in making this decision for their children, but really it's gone beyond that at this stage. Children need to be able to go onto the online world in a safe and protected manner, and government needs to step in to make sure that those safe online spaces are provided for children.
Now, it was referenced in Sheila's report, but it stands true. A lot of parents are worried that if their child doesn't have a smartphone, they'll be excluded, not even necessarily deliberately, but, left out of conversations and plans, and that could cause its own set of problems.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the most difficult things for parents at the moment, that they're torn between this dilemma of whether to have fear that their child might be socially excluded in their physical world, but the other side of that is giving the internet this totally unregulated, unprotected space access to their child throughout the day. So it's brilliant, I suppose, in the midterm, before government gets its act together, that parents are coming together to say, well, actually, do you know what? Let's decide that as a group, we're going to give ourselves the choice to say, no, you're not going to be the only one. There are lots of children. I'm giving talks across North County Wicklow and South Dublin at the moment, one a week and sometimes two a week, to groups of parents like this that are setting up in nearly every single secondary school I'm going to, who are just trying to hold off and create. And most of them have over 100 members in each, deciding to either hold off on smartphones until the appropriate regulation is put in place.
Whatever about regulation and the need for it, there's a counter argument that, look, this all comes down to parental responsibility and taking the steps to actively monitor your child's phone usage. What would you say to that?
That's fine if you're a parent in a community that affords you the ability to be able to engage in your child's life as actively as some of these parents can. But there are lots of parents around the country who don't have the wherewithal and don't have the time and the energy. Mm. They're spending it trying to put food on the table. And the idea that they would be able to monitor their child's online access 24 hours a day is ridiculous. The government needs to step in and hold the social... we have a Children's First Act in this country that sets out criteria for every single person who's going to engage with a child in the physical world to make sure that child is safeguarded in a way that they are free from risk of harm. There's no such thing yet for the online world, and yet our children are spending a huge amount of time online every single day. Over 80% of them in bed at night, every night. Who else do we allow into our children's bed with them every night?
You're talking about regulation, but practically what would that mean? As in, would it mean a child being prohibited by law from owning a smartphone, or would it be more about social media companies being forced to take greater responsibility?
No, it's absolutely not about restricting children from the online world, and we need to be really clear about that. It's about creating a safe online space for children to be able to access all of the brilliant things that the online world does provide for them, from accessing their rights to entertainment, to education, to the information. But we've got to, nobody yet has set out the criteria for what a safe online world looks like. And I'll tell you very, very simply what that is. It's an online world that is free from exposure to porn, free from exposure to extremely violent content, free from being contacted or solicited by strangers or adults that you don't know, by predatory activities by adults, by inappropriate messaging, and the likes of that Simon Harris was talking about, by, you know, on their health and well-being, teaching them how to be young men and women in the world growing up.
Difficult to achieve, though. You mentioned Simon Harris there. He felt that the Netflix drama Adolescence should be shown in every secondary school. It's very dark subject matter. Do you agree that it should be shown?
I've spoken to Simon Harris directly on this, and I'm delighted to hear that he's taking it so seriously. But if he thinks the answer is going to be showing a TV show in secondary schools across the country, he needs to look at it just a little bit more closely. Absolutely, it'd be a great conversation starter for secondary school students. But the truth is, secondary school students are living this. I've talked to them about the adolescence show. There's nothing new for them in that. They know about this. They deal with it and they try and regulate it for themselves every day. Who needs to watch the show Adolescence is every single parent in the country, so that we finally give the government a mandate to start doing what they need to do, which is protecting children from these kind of online spaces.
That was Owen Cleary, secondary school teacher at Temple Carrig in Greystones, County Wicklow, speaking to Joan O'Sullivan on today's Morning Ireland. Staying on the topic of mobile phones, musician and podcaster Niall Breslin, Brezzy, told Brendan O'Connor on Saturday why he has ditched his smartphone for one day a week.
What is your Nokia Sunday, Brezzy?
It's the new mask, Brendan.
Yeah.
It was more out of necessity, to be honest with you. I am in the kind of business end of a PhD and book deadlines and all the other stuff that comes with it. And I kind of just got that wake-up call that most of us were getting, that I was being completely and utterly swallowed by my phone. And it wasn't normal. It was almost, it's almost like you were so absorbed and suffocated by it that I wasn't getting any of this done. And it was just out of pure distraction. And the Nokia Sunday, I was up in hardware store and I saw one of those awful Nokias. Those of you old enough to remember, you got a free one when you joined a bank in college. And I bought it. It was 20 quid. And I said to my parents, the people I love, because my biggest anxiety is if somebody I love needs me and they can't get hold of me, that freaks me out. So I said, there's their number. Don't ring me unless you need me. And I just used the Nokia on a Sunday. And it's okay. People wonder the simplicity of that. It is quite simple, but the effectiveness of it is actually much more profound than it sounds.
Yeah, I can imagine if you're like breathing out already at the idea of that. So, okay, let's go back then. Do you think you were on some level addicted to your smartphone?
I mean, it's a word we use. There's definitely addictive behaviour in it. Like I noticed it because I started to do pretty, you know, pretty full on digital detoxing, and I was getting all those responses of deep anxiety, sweating, physiological responses to it. I was going to the toilet like and checking for my phone. Like, when did that happen? It became so automatic and so ingrained in me that I, from my own perspective, and this isn't me pontificating on people using their phone, from my own personal perspective, this wasn't normal. I didn't like this. I didn't like this about me. I didn't like to feel that I had that control kind of taken from me. So that's where it started. And I started developing out my own personal detoxing, and the impact was massive.
Was there a straw that broke the camel's back, do you think?
Yeah, there was just a few things. I think ultimately, one of them for me was I got to that point. I got, you know, when you get the notification of how long you use your phone for. And I was under this deadline and I was freaked out by the deadline. I was like, I don't have enough time in my day to get this done. It's not going to be delivered. And when you have deadlines and you work the way I work, which is off contract, you're breaching contract if you don't reach the deadline. There's very real consequences to this stuff. So I just realized I got this text that said I'd use my phone 11 hours a day on average. Yeah. And I felt physically sick. I was like, there's something wrong here. Because like, I was fighting for hours. I was looking for an hour in a day to get the writing done. And I was spending 11 hours on my phone, which was, that's not normal.
Okay, so talk me through the process. I mean, going cold turkey is probably unrealistic for people in reality, isn't it? So talk me through, you have a kind of a 4-week plan, yeah? A process that you went through for changing your relationship with the phone.
Yeah, and I think the other thing about it is I some of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life have been on my phone. I've learned to do things like I'm not the, you know, censor, big bad wolf. And I know you had Jonathan Haidt on, whose work is just phenomenal. It's given us the data. It's given us the research. It's allowed us understand the true extent of what's happening. So I, like everything in the world, it requires balance. So I kind of decided the way to approach it was over 4 weeks. And week one, what I did is I took one app off my phone a day of the apps I used the most. So by the end of that week, 7 apps were gone.
How did that feel?
That was actually pretty easy. That was fine, because some of the apps, like, I honestly, like if we can get rid of WhatsApp, my life would be a hell of a lot easier. I find that the worst because there's an entitlement to your attention. People, if they text you or they send you a message, almost feel there's a cultural entitlement to say, you must get back to me. And if you don't, there's something wrong. That, once again, is not normal. We've normalised that in culture. And
yeah, like you hear the kids saying that someone left them on red, like... It's like a human rights outrage.
But I'm the same. When someone does it to me, then I get like we try to pretend and be self-righteous about this, but I do the same thing. If I send a message and someone doesn't get back to me, I then send another one. And the worst phrase in modern culture is a gentle reminder. I hate that phrase more than a gentle reminder that you haven't got back to me within 14 seconds. The second week I did what I call 777. The phone goes off at 7 p.m. doesn't go on till 7 a.m. for 7 days. Try it. Okay. It's simple. People will then, they'll quantify it and justify it and say they need for work. Get a Nokia. I'm not sponsored by Nokia. Just get one. Give those people your number. People don't need to text you outside work hours.
And how did that feel that week like? I mean, you must have been antsy.
Your problem is you end up replacing it with like depressing soaps and serial killer murders on Netflix, but you do. And it was what Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, like this is actually what he said. He said their biggest competitor in the marketplace wasn't Facebook, wasn't Amazon, it was sleep. So we've commodified sleep in the marketplace. It is a commodification. When we're doing that and we talk about attention, we really have to get a little bit more real about this. So these are the people whose jobs are designed to make sure we don't sleep and our attention isn't on the things that we probably should be doing, including the people we love, which is a huge part of my own reasons why I got off the phone. Week three was probably the hardest, where you're only allowed to use your phone for 3 hours a day, which people will go, that's a lot of time. But actually, if you look at the average time people are using their phones, that's well below half of it. And then week four is no smartphone.
Okay, so tell me about the 3 hours a day then. Did you give a specific 3 hours where the phone is on and then it's off outside those 3 hours?
You can choose. I mean, if kids are in school, the last thing you want them is where they can't use their phones coming home from school and using it for 3 hours. I mean, for me, for somebody who works for themselves, who's at home, who enjoys certain, and it's important for me, Brendan, I do feel I want to understand what's going on in the world and I care greatly. So I do feel part of that is I want to keep myself updated. I want to understand.
Yeah.
So I don't want to just pretend the world doesn't exist outside my four walls. But 3 hours is enough to do that. And then the fourth week was no smartphone. And then I did that before quite a big endurance event that I was doing. And so I was being measured. All my metrics were being measured. My heart rates, my heart rate variability, boring things like that.
Yeah.
But there was a dramatic impact on even my heart rate dropped. My heart rate variability increased. My sleep. All of this, all these metrics went up through the roof.
Was there a huge anxiety initially? Because you know, if your phone breaks or goes into water or whatever, I always find the first few hours like I feel like I'm, you know, missing my right hand or something, and then you calm down a bit, don't you, and kind of settle into it.
Well, this is the thing, it's actually to feed into that anxiety. One of the other elements of the modern cultural world we've created is that we've become really, really kind of almost allergic to discomfort. We have almost this belief that we should never feel uncomfortable or uneasy. And being uncomfortable and uneasy is part of life. It's just one of those things. So actually sense into that anxiety when you come off your phone. It will be there. But my biggest anxiety was the people that need me can't get hold of me. That was one I couldn't let go, which was kind of solved by the fact that I still have a phone. But I don't have access to the entire world in that phone. There's no WhatsApp. And I actually looked like at the different apps and people would say, you know, Instagram, X. I deleted X 3 long before Musk came along. I was like, I'm out. This isn't normal. This isn't a normal platform. The way we talk to each other, all civil discourse is gone. I'm out. It's where context goes to die. So I deleted that 4 years ago. And then the big thing for me around that is that anxiety is perfectly normal. Sit with it. And it does ease. It definitely eases. But with the week without the phone, the difference it made, I cannot describe it. And I mean, there's huge research starting to come out now around.
So go on, tell me, like, are you more present?
That's the first one. I think our relationships, the people around us, you know, the people that we're closest to, at a time in the world does feel like it's absolutely imploding. And, you know, we see what we see. A way to kind of help you get through that is in your community. And you can't be in your community if you're not there. You have to be present with people and you have to be present in your relationships. That was one huge element for me. The other one was, and the thing about it is what we also done is we've hijacked this idea of like when we take presence time, then we can be more productive. Productive is just a neoliberal word. Like, how do we make people more productive so that they can work more, so they can create more for the economy? We need to talk more about how do we teach people to rest. And it's not normal. This once back to the normality thing. People talk about, you know, I was called the champagne socialist by an American yesterday online because I was talking about these things. I said, it's not socialism to expect people not to work 60 to 8 hour weeks. It's not socialism to expect that people can go home after a day of work and not be contacted. That we've normalized that very recently. That's a very new thing in sociology. And we have an opportunity to actually address it before it becomes completely ingrained in how we think.
But listen, work aside, we do it to ourselves as well, don't we? Because, like, basically, any lull in anything, if you're waiting a minute for something, you have to distract yourself straight away, like, in case you'd be bored for a second.
Oh, God, being bored is, like, isn't it? I always joke about this at Mindfulness. It's like, when is sitting on your arse doing nothing become the most difficult thing for us to do now? It's people go, oh, jeez, I couldn't do that. I couldn't sit down and do nothing. Because what we do is we have those lads on TikTok who come on and tell you they've done 2 days' work before 9 a.m. They've gone to the gym 3 times before 10 p.m. and then they're injecting green stuff into the you-know-where. And you're sitting and you're trying to rest, and you sense consistently that you got to do better, because these people with the emotional music in the background, and you know those TikTok videos, there's one of a guy who tries to manipulate time and he says, I have more than 24 hours in a day. And you're sitting here just trying to eat a tube of Pringles and relax and watch TV and feel yeah. like I'm doing something fundamentally wrong here. And that's back to the Nokia Sundays. Sundays, I'm not religious, but it was always a day of rest. And in athletes, the top athletes in the world will tell you the most important day in their week is rest and recovery, because that's how you improve, that's how you get your gains, that's how you find a little balance. And I think we've hijacked rest. And I think rest is a bad word, and it translates into lack of ambition. And in this kind of neoliberal world where ambition at all costs seems to be what we're all driven by, I think we've got to start some form of rest revolution, and that starts with the phone. Like, we got to take the power back on that side of things. And it ain't easy, and I don't pretend it is, but I would not suggest you just don't stop using your phone. Just find little ways of it working, like the way I did. And that mightn't work for you, but it worked very well for me.
Okay, so basically you've become a little bit less reliant on it overall is the result.
Yeah, and you've actually feel like this is the point, as people go, it made me more productive. It wasn't about making me more productive. I wanted to be more present. I wanted to be with, you know, around people I loved and actually be with them. And that's important to me now in my 40s.
Brezzy chatting to Brendan O'Connor on Saturday. Always a popular guest on Today with Claire Byrne is Dr. Rosemary Coleman, consultant dermatologist who answers plenty of listeners' questions. And today was focusing on melasma.
But we want to start by talking about this particular condition. It's called melasma, or people might know it as the mask of pregnancy. So what is that?
Well, it's an inflammatory skin condition which manifests as pigmentation, typically on the face. It drives people mad because it can be very hard to camouflage. Typically, you'll see it along the tops of the cheekbones, sometimes the centre of the forehead, or it can be a reverse pattern and drift down the cheeks. Most commonly in women, but 1% can occur in men. So while it's called the mask of pregnancy and is associated with pregnancy and the combined oral contraceptive pill, I think the vast majority of women I see with it have no association with pregnancy or the pill.
Oh, so why is it happening then? Do we know?
It would appear to have hormonal influences, because we very rarely see it postmenopausally. There's probably a genetic component. It could be triggered by various chemicals, just like pigmentation can be caused on the neck if you wear perfume. So that's not a good idea. And by and large, it's unknown. It's one of those inflammatory skin conditions.
Mm-hmm. But is it treatable?
Yes, it's very treatable. But what I say is it's controllable rather than curable. So that people have to stick with it until it will burn itself out and it will go away. As I said, no matter how bad it is, I rarely ever see it post-menopause years. Now, I know that's a long time to wait for an improvement, but in the meantime, you could avoid triggers that you might find makes it worse. Some people are made worse by heat, not just sun. So avoid saunas or situations like that. Sunblock like in bed at night practically, Claire, because zinc oxide with iron oxide is the best sunblock for melasma, but it would have to be reapplied fastidiously every 2 hours if you have this medical condition. Mm-hmm. Lots of sunblock, 365 days a year, but particularly from March till October when the UV changes, look at the beautiful day we have today, the light's bright, and don't forget, through the windows, you can be aggravating your melasma. And then we have medical treatments.
Like sort of is it a laser treatment that you would use on
yes,
that?
Yes, I'm going to just say one other point while we're on that about treatment. Screens don't seem to make it worse. There was a myth for a while that people on computers all day and on the phone, and it turns out that the blue light isn't strong enough to aggravate your melasma.
Okay.
So that's just worth mentioning.
Yes, it is.
Medical treatments, I find one of the best is, apart from my prescription treatments, which are usually the best with hydroquinone, vitamin C, kojic acid, etc., retinols in some situations, but one of the best interventions is very intense medical microneedling. Now, that's not just where you roll a little derma roller over your face. You come in, we put a strong local anesthetic cream on, and we microneedle deep into the skin. And we find that three intense medical microneedling treatments in a row, 1 month apart, is probably our best treatment. If that fails, we will use lasers, a variety of different lasers. Mm-hmm. Might be worth avoiding IPL if it's very active, because IPL can actually make it worse.
Okay.
So you have to be careful with the laser energy, that you don't create too much heat, because the heat could aggravate mm-hmm. the melasma.
Okay. Well, listen, let's move on to the questions then, because we have so many of them, as always. So this first one, I'm covered in brown spots. They appear in places that never see the sun, on my back, under my breasts. They're all over my legs, especially. I'm in my 60s. I've quite sallow skin. My mother had them too, but she was fair, blonde, red haired. My legs particularly bother me. I wear fake tan in the summer. I'm not sure if they look better or worse. I always wear a high sun factor. And she's saying that laser might be unaffordable on the legs. So clearly these spots now are bothering her. But I just wonder, is there any medical reason to be concerned here?
Well, there's a very wide differential. There is one disorder that just came to mind as you were speaking, with a big long name, disseminated superficial actinic porokeratosis.
Right.
And that can occur all over the body, because I'm trying to think of something that's going to occur on her, some protected sites as well. And that would be worth checking out, because it is theoretically a precancerous condition, although I've only seen a skin cancer in it once in 35 years. But fake tan could accumulate in that, and it could look worse with the fake tan. Mm. So whilst it could be sun damage, I think she'd know that if it's uncovered places like her buttocks and armpits, you're talking about completely different disorders. Certain yeast infections and fungal infections can look like brown spots. It's called pityriasis versicolor, but that would tend to be confined to the trunk and upper limbs. I'm sure she's not talking about moles, because she'd know it if it was a mole. It's very unlikely to be cafe au lait. It sounds far too extensive. So it sounds like a very interesting eruption. And
so from what you've heard there, you're saying that that needs to be checked, right?
Well, she wants a diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know, because then you know, once you have a diagnosis, you'll know if anything can be done. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't think laser is an option when it's that extensive.
Right. OK, so get medical advice on that one is where we're at there. So this is from a woman who is 48 and perimenopausal. I have rosacea for 20 years. I have an IUD since September 2024. And since then, I've developed regular acne all over the face. Is there anything that would help the new acne issue apart from coming off the IUD? Now, the IUD is because this person had extreme period cramps.
Right. Well, the solution for that person is take out the IUD. We often have to recommend that. But then we have situations where it's in for gynecological reasons. Mm. In that situation, we would have to keep her on medications for as long as she has the IUD. And it's the progesterone in the IUD that is causing acne. The same would happen to her if she got the implant in her arm, like a lot of teenage girls will get acne from the implant, and they should take it out and go for a combined contraceptive pill, or indeed if she went on the progesterone-only pill, the same would happen. So she will need systemic therapy, i.e. anti-inflammatory antibiotics or low-dose long-term Roaccutane for as long as she needs that IUD.
Right, okay. So if you need the IUD, you're going to need treatment for the acne.
Correct.
Okay. My sister is going through chemo for breast cancer. She's broken out in a red lumpy rash on her face. She's been given steroid cream. Is there anything else that might help? Have you heard of that before?
Chemo causes rashes every day of the week.
Yeah.
And the oncologist in charge of that patient will arrange for a dermatologist to see her and give her the appropriate treatment. So the answer is yes, it's more than likely caused by chemo, but of course not necessarily, but more than likely. So she would need a treatment so that she can continue with her chemo.
There might be more out there, though, are you suggesting, than the steroid cream she's on?
Oh, absolutely. She may well need tablets.
Right. Okay. I have another one here. This is from Margaret, who recently developed a rash on the back of her legs above the knee. It's not itchy, but it feels like sandpaper to the touch. So we can imagine that. It's starting to spread to the front, but I don't have it anywhere else on my body. What might that be?
It could be psoriasis. It could be dermatitis. It could be a contact dermatitis. Mm. It could be a seat she's sitting on that's releasing plasticizers or colorings.
Oh.
It could be in her clothes. She could have a clothing contact dermatitis because that area of a pair of jeans will be most in contact with her skin sitting down. If she gets hot and sweaty, you could leach the dye out. So if it's getting itchy, it sounds like dermatitis and she might need allergy testing.
She's saying it's not itchy,
it's not
but it
itchy.
Feels like sandpaper. I mean, some people have a skin condition, don't they, where their skin is bumpy.
Yes, Claire.
On the legs.
Very
what is
good.
That?
Keratosis pilaris.
Okay.
Typically down the sides of the thighs and the front, typically would be present on the outer arms and sometimes the outer cheek and even the outer eyebrow as well. Keratosis pilaris tends to occur in youth and reduces as you get older. I haven't come across it coming on for the first time in an adult at that age.
Right.
So I'm afraid she needs to be seen.
Mm. Okay, fair enough. Can't say fairer than that. This is from a 45-year-old woman who had her second child 7 years ago. Since then, my torso, front and back are covered in flat warts. So she's tried cryotherapy, but there are too many to remove. Is there anything else that can be done? They're awful and they're really knocking my confidence. And she tells us that she's otherwise very healthy, no other issues.
I think she has developed an eruption. It's called seborrheic keratosis, and that can occur in pregnancy where you can actually suddenly get covered in them, and they are completely benign. They're not viral. This is now based on the history because obviously I can't see them.
Yeah,
they're not viral. So they're not warts, but they are called seborrheic warts, but they're not contagious. They can occur in pregnancy. I'm afraid the treatment for those is liquid nitrogen like she has had. But she would work her way through it serially, maybe do, it's very painful, so do a region at a time, clear them. And then they should stay away. A lot of the time when they erupt in pregnancy like that, they often reduce after the pregnancy, so she's unlucky.
Right. Hasn't pregnancy got an awful lot to answer for?
But look at the end result.
I suppose there is that. Now, this is from a man who's in his early 60s. He says he has skin tags on the inside of the upper thigh area. And what is the best way to get rid of those?
Very common. And they are usually tags and polyps. And they just need to be snipped off. Often cryotherapy isn't good enough for those because they can be quite big and the base is small. And the easiest thing is a little prick of local anaesthetic all over them and then just snip them off, cauterize them.
I'm saying ouch, but it's not ouch because there's a local anaesthetic.
Local anaesthetic. The GP might be able to do that. Otherwise, obviously, a dermatologist.
Do they come back then, though?
Often, and again, I don't know this gentleman, often they are associated with increased BMI. And if the person loses the weight, they may go. But there can be a genetic tendency. There's a disorder called acanthosis nigricans, where the skin there can be brown and velvety and also covered with these. And indeed, it's probably worth mentioning that that can be associated with insulin resistance and subsequently diabetes.
Right.
So, you know, if they're just simple polyps and tags on completely normal skin, snip them off. If it's acanthosis nigricans, get a medical workup.
Okay, so if there's a discoloration there.
Yes, or brown, velvety, skin. Thickened skin.
Okay. Now, this listener has a daughter aged 12 who has really bad eczema, flare-up since Christmas. She hasn't had it since she was 5, so it's a relatively new thing. She had been on prescription acne topical treatment for 6 months before Christmas, and they feel it was a combination of the very cold weather in January combined with some Christmas makeup gifts targeted at pre-teens that brought it on. She's doing emulsifying ointment twice a day and over-the-counter hydrocortisone. And while that works for a while, we're in a constant cycle of flare-up when there's no hydrocortisone in the mix. So when they stop using that, they have the flare-up. It's now spread to her arms. It's like spots with heads. She's very itchy. What to do? And they're also worried about continuing with the hydrocortisone indefinitely.
Very good. So she has facial eczema and now she has it on the arms.
Yes.
And she has pustules. So she has infected eczema and she could do very well with antibiotics and appropriate skincare, such as the oily baths. I say to people, go to the shelf in the chemist for children with eczema, diaper bath, oilatum, all these over-the-counter preparations. I find that people who have had eczema rarely tolerate the topical acne roll-ons that we use. So I will rarely use topical therapy creams and lotions for acne in people who've had eczema. They don't tolerate them and it will trigger their eczema. Mm-hmm. So I would try to stop that. She'll probably need tablets for her acne and indeed dietary manipulation instead. There is another cream called Protopic, which is a non-steroid, which would be the treatment of choice for chronic long-term facial eczema because it's not a steroid, it won't thin her skin, it won't cause cataracts, glaucoma or any other side effects like that.
Is that a prescription
and
cream?
And it's a prescription.
Okay, Protopic.
So, Protopic. So I'd pop into the GP, discuss getting Protopic and a course of antibiotics and consider stopping the what's probably Zinaret or Dalacin for her acne.
Okay.
And change her pillowcase because it's all over her pillowcase.
Ah, on the subject though of the Christmas makeup gifts targeted at preteens.
Don't touch them.
Yeah, and I know you have this view, but I mean, there's so much out there now. It's heavily marketed. I mean, you have 10-year-olds who are into it, but really, we need to be careful.
Well, I think we have to be parents. And I had one parent who said that her child was asking for all these crazily expensive, coloured, we won't name the labels, but all these brands. And the mother was very sensible. She went into Boots, got her daughter a pile of bottles with lovely coloured lids and labels, filled them all with over-the-counter Elav, La Roche-Posay, Aven, safe little skin cream, so that when the child's friends came home from school, she had her own little pharmacy stash, and she didn't feel left out.
Good
but
idea.
Don't put those on the child's skin.
Consultant dermatologist Dr. Rosemary Coleman on Today with Claire Byrne. Ray Darcy's guest was author and podcaster Claire Walsh, who shared her journey of fertility treatments.
Child is not by choice. It's a really brutal club to be part of, to be dead honest with you. Yeah, I'm 42 and I started trying to have a child just before I turned 40, you know, with my husband. So I wasn't naive.
When did you meet your husband?
I met my husband, I'm going to get in trouble, 37 or 38. Around that time.
Yes.
So, you know, I certainly was that little bit older. We weren't, you know, school sweethearts or anything like that.
And did you have the chat about children?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I would have been fairly straight up. This is what I want. This is what I'm looking for. Do our views match on this?
Right.
So,
and you're of an age.
I am of an age, unfortunately. And I think there's no getting away from that.
So it gives that conversation a little bit more importance, a lot more importance,
definitely.
Actually.
Definitely. Like I could have gotten into a relationship for a couple of years and then we realise we're not on the same page. And then I would have been, you know, so you want to have these conversations from the outset, or certainly I did. Mm.
So for you, it was a deal breaker.
Yeah,
for some people
absolutely.
It isn't, but for you
for
it was.
Some people it isn't, but for me, I always imagined being a mother. It was never a question mark in my head. It was always something I wanted. I knew that without a doubt.
Yeah. And Boody,
Boody. Yeah.
Boody. Is that short for...
It is short for name, but I'm going to butcher it by saying Abdel Rahman. He's Egyptian.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Boody then was on the same page.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Family is really important to him.
Yeah. Okay. So that's fine. And you're looking at a future of...
Yeah. And we're just about to get married and, you know, we start trying. And it's really funny. You kind of... You start trying and months go by and nothing happens. And I thought I was being really proactive. So I booked in an appointment to just start the explorations. And I don't know if it was a mixture of smugness or naivety, but I thought by the time the appointment came around, I probably wouldn't need it because I'd be pregnant. And these appointments kept on coming up. You know, there would be another one with a consultant or, you know, for some sort of exploration or exam down the road, 6 weeks down the road, and you pop it in your diary and you'd kind of think to yourself, I'll probably have to cancel it because everything will have worked out. Mm. And when you're kind of 6, 7, 8 months into that, things begin to feel a little bit different.
So what was going through your head?
Well, you know, like I said, you know, we were having appointments, we were consulting with doctors and, you know, IVF is always kind of on the table at that point, or certainly it's been put on the table and you do think we won't need it. But I do remember a particular weekend, and it was around the time or shortly after my book came out. So it felt like going from one whirlwind into the next. But that weekend, that realisation of... This might not happen for us the way it does for so many other couples. We might have to get extra help. Mm. We might have to spend quite a lot of money. We might have to invest so much of ourselves to extend our family. And that weekend, I don't think I'll ever forget.
So was there test results or something, Claire?
No, this is the whole thing. Well, certainly for me, it's unexplained infertility. And right. I think this is really, really common. We don't always find the reason. There's no reason on paper why I wouldn't.
Because we like reasons. We,
we
to
love
know
reasons
why
because
go wrong. Yes.
Then we can do something about it. But the not knowing, it's really, really tough. But also it then leaves the door open for hope. If we don't have a reason why it shouldn't happen, that means it might. So you kind of keep on going and you get caught up.
And you hear all the stories, don't you?
Oh, you hear all the stories. And you know what? Those stories are important, but IVF, in my scenarios, that's a treatment I pursued. It's not always the silver bullet. Mm. And in fact, it isn't a lot of the times.
And were you sharing this with friends, family, or is it a very private thing?
My husband's really private. I process things by talking, but I found the more I got into it, the less I spoke about it because you're really, really vulnerable and people mean well, but they often, I think people want to solve. People want to say, you know, I have a cousin and she's 72. She's got 3 children and they're all one. You hear all these stories. And
you hear the stories about, and they adopt it and then they have children naturally.
Exactly. Have you tried going on a holiday or relaxing or having a glass of wine and you're kind of gritting your teeth and going, if it was that easy.
They mean well. People mean well.
Of course they mean well. But I do think there is a really big gap around the understanding of what that person is going through. Mm. And it does require a lot of grace to hear the intention.
Of course, we live in a world now where, you know, we feel that we can solve most things.
Of course.
Like back in the day, it would have, you know, you would have just, that's our lot.
That's it, exactly. But you know what, Ray, like I find myself, if someone comes to me and they say, Claire, I'm really struggling with this, I automatically roll up my sleeves and I'll start Googling and I go, right, what can we do? So I understand that need to solve, to fix.
So it was IVF then?
So we pursued IVF treatment.
When did you have your first round of IVF?
First round was August of that year, so that's 2023. And that didn't go very well. I didn't respond well at all to the drugs. So the cycle was cancelled quite early on. And that was, again, I remember that phone call quite clearly. It was a Friday afternoon. And again, it's another inkling, another, I suppose, red flag, I think the kids call it, of, oh, I don't think this is going to be straightforward.
Yeah, because it, like... the success rate with IVF isn't huge.
It's still quite low. And, you know, I remember telling people at the start, you know, we're going to try IVF, and their reaction is, that's really exciting. And I get the idea of it, but the reality of IVF is not exciting.
I don't know if everybody understands what you have to go through.
No, they don't.
What are the steps?
Oh, gosh. So there's lots and lots of consultations. And I think before you get to the consultation period, and I speak on my episode this week of the podcast with Helena Tuberty, and she speaks about this with such an articulate manner and with such expertise. By the time you get to the clinic, you've probably spent thousands of euro in doctor's appointments, in different explorations, let's call them. So you're already kind of in the deficit financially and probably emotionally. So by the time you get to the clinic, and let's say you settle on your clinic, you settle on your treatment plan, and then you go to the chemist with your prescription, and you come home with a big bag of drugs. And in that bag of drugs are a load of injections.
Right.
And it's funny, I think that's the idea people have of IVF. They'll see it on TV shows or whatever it is. And in my head, that was the scariest part.
This is to get your body ready.
Yeah, exactly. So it's called stimulation, or, you know, stimming. So, you know, I was I'm terrified of injections anyway, so I really wasn't looking forward to that part. But for any women listening who are about to start IVF, that part is absolutely fine.
Mm.
You adapt to it really, really quickly. You become a pro really, really quickly. And that's another really hard part of the whole process, is you're suddenly dropped into this world that has its own language, its own protocols, its own things you have to become really adept at really quickly because the stakes are so high.
Yeah. So you prepare your body, and it is all about you.
Yeah.
And then at some stage then they decide.
So you prepare your body.
Going to harvest. They use words like harvest.
Yeah. What's it? Retrieval. Egg retrieval.
Sorry,
that's it.
Sorry, egg retrieval.
No, I think harvest has been used in some contexts.
Yes.
So you do your stimulation. That can last kind of from 10 to 17 days. I'm sure there's variations on that. And along the way, you're going into the clinic. You're getting, you know, internal scans. So they're monitoring your follicles. Are they growing? Is there enough growing? And then they're also doing blood tests to measure hormones. So, you know, everything is being monitored. And the goal is to get to a place that you have enough follicles at a decent size for egg retrieval.
Uh-huh.
I didn't make it to egg retrieval that first time round.
Okay.
I did make it to egg retrieval at a later point, but fell at the next hurdle. And then the next time we did it, we fell at the hurdle after that.
So you're getting a little bit further each time.
Yeah.
How many treatments did you do, rounds of?
This is a really funny, I was kind of trying to count them. I've started 7 cycles.
Oh, that's a lot.
Started them. I didn't get very far into some of them and got further along the way. We kind of had, I call it like a false finish, because we said we were done. This time last year, actually, it was exactly March, just after St. Paddy's Day, we said we were done. We had an egg retrieval, and getting that step further was a little bit harder. It became that little bit more tangible. That sense of loss, oh, I think I'll remember that one again for years and years to come.
So when you're going through it, you must be hyper aware of your body. Are you thinking, oh, that means something?
Completely. Something. Yes. And you're willing yourself not to go onto Google. You know, you're Googling every symptom. It feels crazy, like the drugs. They're no joke.
Mm-hmm.
You're injecting, you know, quite a lot of synthetic hormones into your body. So that comes with its own set of side effects. It's a really, really, well, for me anyway, all this is my experience. But for me, it was a really weird, surreal, stressful time.
And how were you told each time that it hadn't been successful?
You're not really. Again, it goes back to those success rates. You know, it is expected for it to take a few rounds. So when the first one doesn't work, they're not getting terribly worried. You're moving into the next round again. But with each round comes a cost. And, you know, the financial cost of IVF, I think, is only one part, because the emotional, the physical and the mental cost is also considerable.
And it must it must put pressure on a relationship.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, I don't think I could have anticipated the again, that word, the toll it takes. Because, again, the stakes are so high. Mm. You're talking about your chance of being a mother or your chance of being a father. And then you're talking about, like, of being a grandmother and a grandfather. Like, this will affect us for the rest of our life. This will put us in a category of parents or not parents. This is so huge. So you're putting everything in. So naturally, it's gonna implode from time to time. You know, I've been lucky with my husband. You know, he's a really terrific guy. But it definitely, it caused a strain, and we had to look at it. There was one point where I thought, is this going to implode? Like, is my marriage going to be the ultimate price I pay? And since I've started speaking about it, more and more people have reached out to me saying, we separated after it. It was too much for us. And I can understand why.
Author and podcaster Claire Walsh chatting to Ray Darcy today. Diarmaid Ferriter, Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD, joined Claire Byrne this morning to discuss the history of the Abbey Theatre.
One of the intriguing cultural questions arising from the Irish War of Independence and Civil War period was the fate of the Abbey Theatre. It was established while Ireland was still under British rule, with W.B. Yeats and Lady Augusta Gregory at the helm, and would become one of Ireland's main arenas for art and ideas. Now, while the Abbey wasn't Dublin's first theatre, its arrival was linked to the growing Gaelic revival movement, which has already seen the establishment at that time of the GAA. It was the first of its kind to produce plays that were written by Irish playwrights and performed by Irish actors. And 100 years ago, it became the first state-subsidised theatre in the English-speaking world, earning funding from the newly independent Irish Free State. Well, Diarmaid Ferriter is here now, Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD, to bring us the story of the Abbey. Hello, Diarmaid. Good
morning,
to have
Claire.
You. Now, what was the background to that decision in 1925, the one I just mentioned, where it was going to have state-subsidised funding? Why?
There's a real challenge there with the creation of the new Free State in relation to cultural priorities and what will become of the Abbey. Yeats and Lady Gregory, who you mentioned there, who of course had been stalwarts at the helm of this cultural revival, and they took the business of the Abbey very seriously and legacy very seriously as well. And they are heading into the twilight of their careers at that stage. So they begin discussing this actually during the great period of upheaval, the end of the War of Independence, the start of the Civil War. They're discussing it in late 1921 because their intention had always been to hand over the Abbey Theatre to a new state. They didn't know at that stage what that state would be, and they couldn't have predicted perhaps that it would be civil war and that climate there. But they had been discussing this. And what they are thinking about is, if there's going to be an attempt to establish, say, a rival theatre, if someone like Arthur Griffith or Constance Markievicz, who may have had qualms about the kind of plays that the Abbey did, if they tried to establish a rival theatre, well, then perhaps the Abbey could stay alone and independent as a theatre that stood for intellectual freedom. But the problem for them is financial. Mm-hmm. The overdraft is £2,000 in 1923. They're facing insolvency. So they begin to think again about handing it over, but perhaps with a state subsidy so that they would retain some degree of control. And they use go-betweens like Lennox Robinson, who was also an Abbey playwright. They had certain contacts in the government, like Desmond Fitzgerald and Ernest Blythe, who were government ministers, the new pro-treaty government. And they put their soundings out. What they're looking for is an annual state theatre to keep the theatre solvent. But they don't want to give up artistic control. So there's to-ing and fro-ing. And initially the government is hesitant. They don't necessarily want to be seen in public to be associated with a character like Yeats. I mean, his stock is very high by 1923. He's been awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's world-renowned poet at that stage. But he's also associated with controversy around delicate questions like divorce and partition. He's also in the Shannon as a very independent voice at this stage. So a lot of the work is done behind the scenes. Eventually they agree £1,000 a year as a state subvention. That's reduced to £850 as a result of the straitened financial times and the cost of the Civil War. And it's agreed to, and it is announced exactly 100 years ago in 1925.
So what about that question of artistic control? What conditions came with the 1,000 down to 850?
There were no conditions, in theory. Now, the government is going to have a representative that comes with this state subsidy. And for the announcement of the state subsidy, Yeats, as always, likes to frame particular moments with an eye on posterity. So he invited Blythe into the Abbey for dinner on stage after a performance, and Yeats makes a speech in which he refers to the intelligence, generosity and courage of the government. And he talks about the years of anxious labour that he and Gregory and John Milton Singh had endured in trying to build the Abbey, but that this is the beginning of a new phase and they have an opportunity now to give voice to Irish ideas and Irish minds. Mm-hmm. And the question, of course, is how will this work in practice? There are no strings attached. There isn't an official theatre censor in the way that censorship applies to films and later books. So there is a degree of artistic license there. The question is, what will the government representative want? And the government representative, it turns out, is George O'Brien. And George O'Brien is a renowned economist. And he's there, of course, in theory to financially advise the Abbey Theatre. But in practice, he sees himself as a moral gatekeeper. And that theme of moral gatekeeping in the 1920s is a very strong one. And it only takes a year for this question of artistic freedom versus the subsidy to burst into life and controversy as a result of a very talented playwright, Sean O'Casey, who at this time, 100 years ago, was in his tenement in Dublin's North Circular Road, typing away. He had a sign above his desk saying, "Get on with the bloody play." That bloody play was a bloody good play. It was The Plough and the Stars. He submitted it to the Abbey in the summer of 1925 and they planned to stage it in February 1926. And this began a huge controversy about artistic freedom.
The row erupted then over that play. And so the piece lasted for a year.
It's very interesting because, you know, Lady Gregory was so impressed by this playwright. They had a very interesting relationship, herself and Sean O'Casey, because they came from such different backgrounds. But she was hugely impressed with his use of language, with what she described as the futility and the irony and the tragedy of his plays. And she was really impressed with The Plough and the Stars. And Yeats travelled to Coole Park, to her estate, to talk to her about it, because there were problems with the language. The language was very edgy. And of course, O'Casey was brilliant at making Dublin language sing and cry and dance and provoke. So they knew they would have a difficulty on their hands.
She recorded
in her diary, "Our position is clear. If we have to choose between our freedom and the subsidy, we will choose our freedom."
Mm-hmm.
And she then travelled to Dublin with Yeats. They had a meeting of the board of the Abbey, and George O'Brien, the government representative, was at that. And she gave him a stern lecture on the history of the Abbey's battles with censorship over the years. And he objected in particular to the language of the play. What kind of language was he objecting to? The use of bitch, Jesus, lousers, lice, the presence of a prostitute on stage, the tricolour coming into a pub. And even some of the Abbey actors were having qualms about this. One of them wrote to Yeats and Gregory and said that the language of this play, to use an Abbey phrase, is beyond the beyonds.
Mm.
And some of the actors' confessors wouldn't allow them to say these lines. So, you know, they're taking a serious risk there. But interestingly, this is classic Lady Gregory. She recorded this in her diary. George O'Brien wanted an objectionable song removed from Act Two of the play. And the way she recorded it in her diary was, "We had already decided to get rid of it, but I left it as a bone for him to gnaw at."
Ah, listen, classic negotiation. Let him feel like he has a win. And where did Yeats stand on all of this?
Yeats was fully behind.
He was with her
Lady
on
Gregory,
this.
And he was impressed too. And he also could sense that this might be an opportunity to establish the parameters in relation to the future of the Abbey and its relationship with the state.
Dermot Ferriter, Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD, on Today with Claire Byrne. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.